Mom knows that I don't. Then I go downstairs to feed Minka. Later, Walter asks to see my grades, and when I show them to him, he hits the roof. They're not that bad, I say. I got a C in American cultures, a C in geometry, a B minus in French, a B in English, and an A in typing. Mom thought they were fine, especially since I missed the first 6 weeks of school. With a little effort, you could have had all A's and B's, Walter says. You don't apply yourself. You don't work up to your full potential. How do you know? I ask. I do plenty of studying in school and plenty in my room at night. This is not exactly true. I almost never study at school, except for geometry. I do my geometry homework with Ruben, because he's very good at math. I used to be, but I guess missing all that school really did matter. And at night, I do only what is absolutely necessary. Besides, I say, what difference does it make? It's what you learn that counts, not what grades you get.
Who told you that? Walter asks.
My father? I should have guessed. What's that supposed to mean?
You want to wind up like him? Walter says, raising his voice. With no education? Working in a 7-Eleven store? A wasted life?
How dare you say that my father had a wasted life? You don't know anything! My stomach is all tied up in knots. I am on the verge of tears.
And I'm going to tell Mom what you said about my father. He was a better man than you, in every way. Fine, Walter booms. You tell your mother. Or maybe I'll save you the trouble and tell her for you. Because if your father had been a better man, she wouldn't be where she is now.
That's not true, I shout.
Your mother is another example of a wasted life.
What? I say. What did you say about my mother?
Pregnant in high school and destitute at 34?
Shut up. Just shut up. I rush toward him, calling him every name in the book and pound on his chest with my fists. He grabs me by the wrist and smacks me, hard, right across the face.
I hate you,
I yell.
I've always hated you.
I turn and run out of the room, and as I do, I see that Bitsy and Jason have been in the kitchen the whole time, listening. Upstairs, I get into bed, and when I have calmed down enough, I write another letter to Wolf. Even though I have no address for him and can't mail it, I have to tell someone what is happening. I have to tell someone how my life is falling apart. Someone who will understand. An hour later, Walter knocks on my bedroom door.
Davy, can I come in for a minute?
I have nothing to say to you, I tell him.
But I have something to say to you.
Suit yourself. He opens the door.
I'm sorry, he says. I certainly didn't mean to insult your parents.
I don't take my eyes off the dancing bear, which I am holding in my lap.
I just hoped you'd realize how important education is.
I still don't look at him, but I say, I might want to be a professional singer.
I had no idea, he says. I've never heard you sing. Are you any good?
I don't answer. He lowers his voice.
I'm sorry I slapped you. That was uncalled for and unplanned. I don't believe in violence.
Very funny, I think. All those bombs and missiles, but he doesn't believe in violence.
Can you forgive me? He asks.
Without speaking, I put the dancing bear on my night table, snap off the lamp, roll over in bed, and close my eyes. After a minute, Walter leaves. I hear him walking down the hall. Chapter 31. Jane has promised to try out for Oklahoma with me. We are to meet outside the auditorium after school. I get there first and watch groups of kids file inside. So many people are trying out. Do I even have a chance? I begin to feel anxious, and after 10 minutes, when Jane still hasn't shown, I think about chickening out and going home. But then Jane comes staggering down the hall.
Hi, she says, all bright-eyed. Here I am, ready and willing.
I smell the booze on her breath. Have you been drinking? I say. Of course she has. Why do I bother to ask?
Just a teensy-weensy bit, Jane says, giggling.
It is not the first time that Jane has gotten drunk in school, but I can't believe she would do this today.
You can't try out drunk, I tell her.
Then I can't try out because I'm not getting up there sober,
that's for sure. I look at her a minute, shake my head, then say,
Come on, let's go.
We walk into the auditorium and find two seats together. Mr. Vanderhoot is directing the play with Ms. Dersch, the head of the music department. She announces that she will call three names from the beginning of the alphabet, then three names from the end, until everyone who has signed up has had a turn. We go through Abel and Ackerman before Ms. Dersch says,
Jane Albertson?
Here I am,
Jane calls.
Tell them you've changed your mind, I whisper, grabbing hold of her sleeve.
No,
she says, shaking me off. She walks up the aisle to the steps leading to the stage. I expect her to trip and fall flat on her face, but she doesn't. When she is on stage, she announces her song.
Oh, what a beautiful morning.
And Miss Dersch plays a brief introduction. Jane begins to sing.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day.
She is terrible. She is not only off key, but off tempo too. I am so embarrassed for her, I want to crawl under my seat. I wonder what Mr. Vanderhoot thinks of his prized pupil now. Thank you, Jane, Ms. Dersch says after one chorus. Jane doesn't take her seat again. Instead, she walks by me and whispers,
I'm going to throw up.
I am torn between going to help her and staying for tryouts. I decide to stay. I am too angry at Jane to feel sorry for her. She made her bed. Now let her lie in it, I think. And then I hate myself, because that is exactly what Bitsy would say. Next, Ziegler is called, then Wright, then Wexler. The palms of my hands are sweating. I wipe them on my skirt. I want this part so badly. I go up on stage and announce my song. I listen as Ms. Dersch plays the introduction. Then I begin to sing.
I'm just a girl who can't say no. I'm in a terrible fix. I always say, come on, let's go. Just when I ought to say nix.
I pretend that I am in the shower, singing loud and clear. I let go and smile, actually enjoying myself, as I move around the stage acting out the part of Ado Annie. I'm good. I know it. I can feel it. I release all the energy I've got. When I finish, there is silence. Then Ms. Dersch says,
Thank you, Davy.
In exactly the same way she'd said, Thank you, Jane. That night, Jane calls.
Did I make a fool of myself?
Yes.
What did Ms. Dersch say?
She said, Thank you, Jane.
Really? That's all?
Yes.
And what about Mr. Vanderhoot? What did he say?
Nothing.
God, I'm so embarrassed.
You should be.
I thought you were my friend, Jane says.
I am. That's why I'm telling you. 2 days later, the parts are posted. Jane and I go to the board outside the music center together. She sees my name before I do.
Oh, Davy, you got it!
I can't believe it. I stare at my name. It's true. I got the part.
Congratulations,
I hear over and over again. I don't even know the kids who are congratulating me. Jane didn't even make the chorus. Neither of us is surprised. When I get home from school, Jason is in the kitchen with Bitsy decorating cookies.
I got the part. I made it. I made O Annie.
Davy, that's just wonderful, Bitsy says.
I pick up Jason and dance across the room with him singing, I can't say no.
Help! Put me down!
Jason hollers. I put Jason down and grab a carrot.
You got a letter,
Jason says.
Where?
On the table.
It is a long white envelope. I hope it is from Wolf, but it's not. It's a greeting card. Outside, there's a picture of Snoopy looking forlorn. Inside, it says, "Missing you, Valentine. Love, Hugh." I have forgotten that today is Valentine's Day. I should have known. The cookies Jason is decorating are heart-shaped. I shove the Valentine inside my notebook. It is the first time I have heard from Hugh since September, when he wrote a short letter.
Is Mom home yet?
I ask Bitsy.
She's upstairs showering. Ned's coming over for dinner.
Again? I say, but I don't wait for her to comment. I run upstairs and knock on Mom's door.
I got the part,
I call. Mom opens the door. She is wearing her old terry robe and drying her hair with a towel.
What part?
She says. I can't believe this.
In Oklahoma.
Oh, honey, that's wonderful. You know how much I wanted it, don't you?
Yes, of course. I thought you were talking about something else for a minute. She takes off the robe, tosses it onto the bed, and begins to get dressed.
Why are you wearing that? I ask, as she pulls on her best shirt. It is teal blue silk, and she saves it for special occasions. She wore it last year when she and Daddy celebrated their anniversary.
I just feel like it, Mom says. We're having company for dinner.
Who besides Ned?
No one.
I don't consider him company. He's around all the time. I figure Bitsy is about to adopt him too.
What are you talking about?
You know what I mean. Add him to her collection.
What collection?
Us. Jason, you, me, and now Ned.
Be reasonable, Davy.
I'm not the one who's being unreasonable, Mom.
Before dinner, Jason gives me a Valentine, and I feel badly that I don't have one for him.
Open it,
he says.
I open it and pull out a card made of red colored paper and a doily.
Roses are red, violets are blue. I am your brother, and you are mine too.
I'm your sister, stupid, I say, laughing.
I know, Jason says, but my teacher doesn't. She thinks you're a boy. You have a boy's name.
I hug him.
You're a real character. You know that?
Watch it, he says,
or Count Dracula might bite your neck.
Oh, yeah? Well, Count Dracula better watch it himself, or I'll bite him back.
During dinner, Mom tells the nerd that I got a part in Oklahoma. He says that's terrific and that he was once in the chorus of his high school play. When he smiles, I see that he has a piece of lettuce caught in his teeth. After dinner, Bitsy and Walter leave for their weekly bridge game, and Jason and the nerd sit at the dining room table working on a model airplane. At 9, Mom tells Jason that it's time to go upstairs.
Just a few more minutes,
Jason begs.
It's already 30 minutes past your bedtime, Mom says.
Oh, all right, Jason says. But I want Ned to carry me up.
Ned scoops up Jason and throws him over his shoulder upside down. Jason shrieks. I watch from the floor, where my books are spread out in front of me. I hate seeing Jason acting so chummy with the nerd.
Night, Mom! Night, Davy! Night, Minka!
Jason calls.
Good night! Sleep tight!
Mom answers. I try to concentrate on the paper I'm supposed to be writing for American Cultures, but I feel Mom looking at me. There's a lot of tension between us tonight. He has 2 children of his own, Mom says quietly. He misses them.
Whoop-dee-doo, I say.
Do you have to be so tough on him, Davy?
Who's being tough?
Ned comes back downstairs whistling and settles next to Mom on the sofa.
Would you like a brandy? Mom asks him.
Brandy would be nice.
Mom goes to the kitchen. The nerd smiles at me.
You've got a piece of lettuce caught between your teeth, I tell him. He turns red.
I have made him uncomfortable and I am glad. He picks the lettuce from his tooth, examines it, then deposits it in the glass ashtray. Mom comes back with the brandy and two glasses. She pours each of them a small drink and they clink glasses. I pretend to be engrossed in my schoolwork, but what I'm really thinking is, I'd like to dump the brandy over their heads and tell them how stupid and disgusting they are. Mom says, "Why don't you work at your desk, Davy?" "Trying to get rid of me, Mother?" I ask. "No, I just think your desk is the right place to do schoolwork. The light isn't very good in here." "Since when are you worried about my eyes? Or anything else?" But I gather my books together, stand up, and leave the room. The next morning, while I am getting ready for school, Mom comes into my room. "How would you like to have a session or two with Miriam?" "Miriam?" I say. "Your shrink?" "Yes, she'd like to meet you." "Since when?" "She's always wanted to meet you. And she's easy to talk with," Mom says. "I'll think about it," I tell Mom. Maybe I will go to see Miriam. There are plenty of things I'd like to tell her about my mother. Chapter 32. On Friday, Jane gets drunk in school again, and this time, she makes a scene in the hallway. She throws her books against a row of lockers, whooping and laughing, and then she tosses her purse into the air. Everything tumbles out of it and crashes to the floor. Her mirror smashes into a million pieces, and a bottle of Jean Naté breaks, leaving the hallway smelling like a perfume factory. I clean it all up and help Jane outside before she gets sick. "You have a drinking problem," I tell her. "I can stop anytime I want to," she says. "Like hell." The next day I go to see Miriam. Mama set up an appointment for me, and although I think of canceling at the last minute, I don't. I walk over to her office during lunch period, munching on a sandwich. Miriam turns out to be about 40. She is my height and somewhat overweight, but in a sexy way. Her shirt is unbuttoned enough so that you can tell she isn't wearing a bra. And when she walks across the room, her breasts jiggle. She hikes her skirt over her knees when she sits. She is wearing textured stockings and Western boots. She runs her fingers through her short brown hair several times and smiles. She doesn't seem the Los Alamos type at all. I'm surprised. "So," she says, "how do you like it here, Davy?" "I don't." "Why is that?" "It's such a bore." "Yes, it can be. But it doesn't have to be." "Maybe not," I say. I feel really uncomfortable, sure that Miriam is analyzing every word. "It's a beautiful day, isn't it?" Miriam asks. "We're going to talk about the weather?" I think. What a waste of time. But I answer, "Yes, it's a very nice day." "So, how are things at home, Davy?" "I'm sure my mother's already told you. We're not getting along that well. She mentioned that there's been some tension. That's putting it mildly."
"What do you think is causing it?"
"She is. She's getting to be just like them."
"Like who?"
"Walter and Bitsy, my aunt and uncle."
"In what way?"
"Well, she doesn't think for herself anymore. She does whatever they tell her to do. She lets them make all the decisions. She even lets them choose her friends." I look around the office, convinced that Miriam is recording this conversation so that she can play it back for my mother. "You understand that what's said in this room is between you and me, that it doesn't go any further." I wonder how she knows what I am thinking. "You're not going to tell my mother what I say?"
"No.
I'm here to help you both, not to report on either one of you." "Oh." I sit quietly, folding, then unfolding my hands.
"What bothers you most about your mother becoming more like Walter and Bitsy?"
"They're afraid of everything.
Like what? They won't let me learn to ski. They won't let me take driver's ed. Santa Fe is dangerous. The canyon is dangerous. Just breathing is dangerous.
You feel they're overprotective?
Yes, definitely.
Did your mother used to be less protective? Did she let you try new things before?
Always.
Do you think her reluctance to let you try new things now comes from the circumstances of your father's death?
I don't know, I say, looking out the window. Maybe.
Are you afraid of anything, Davy?
I shrug and don't answer. Halfway through our session, Miriam says, What about Ned? How do you feel about him?
Ned? I say, as if I have never heard the name.
Ned, your mother's friend, Miriam says.
Oh,
you mean the nerd? Miriam laughs and runs her hands through her hair.
Is that what you call him?
Not to his face.
I see.
I think he's a creep, I say. And I don't care if you tell my mother because it's true.
Miriam nods.
My father was very handsome, and he was smart even though he never went to college. And he was funny too. No one around here has any sense of humor. If it weren't for Jason, nobody in our house would ever laugh. But my father always had us in stitches.
You miss him?
Yes, I miss him.
I feel myself choking up and turn away.
You're angry, aren't you?
Miriam says.
Sometimes, I tell her. It's okay to feel angry, Miriam says, as long as you admit it and try to understand it.
When my hour is up, I tell Miriam about Jane and her drinking. Miriam hands me some literature and suggests that I get Jane over to the alcohol abuse clinic.
There's no charge, she says. Then she asks if I will come to see her again.
Maybe, I say.
I'm still not sure that I can trust her.
So I go home and write another letter to Wolf. There are six of them in the trunk now. I wonder how long it will be before the lizards run again.
Chapter 33. The first orchestra rehearsal of Oklahoma is held on the afternoon of my 16th birthday. And when I get home from school, I find that Bitsy has fixed a special dinner with my favorite foods, chicken marengo, spinach noodles, and watercress salad. She has invited Jane over. I am surprised and pleased. The nerd is there too. He gives me a t-shirt that says, A woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle. He tells us that he sent away for it after seeing the ad in Ms. Magazine. I don't get it, but everyone else seems to think it's funny. So I laugh along with them and thank the nerd. Bitsy and Walter give me a digital watch. I didn't expect anything so grand, and I'm really touched. I kiss Bitsy on the cheek, and then I have to thank Walter. I haven't said a word to him since the night he insulted my parents and slapped me. Now I face him. Thank you very much. I say it formally.
You're welcome.
He answers in the same tone.
Enjoy it. He doesn't look at me. I get the feeling he is as uncomfortable about that night as I am. Mom gives me a beautiful silver and turquoise bracelet. It is my first piece of Indian jewelry. I put it on my right wrist, since I am already wearing my new watch on my left. Jason has painted a picture for me and has written another poem. This one says, Roses are red, violets are blue. You are my friend, and I am yours too.
Is that better? He asks.
Yes. Much. I tell him, giving him a hug.
Hey, let go, he says. You're squeezing my hemorrhoids.
What hemorrhoids? I ask, surprised.
Ha ha.
He laughs.
Fooled you, didn't I?
Even though I'm having a good time, I can't help thinking that my father and I had planned a weekend trip to New York for my 16th birthday. He was going to take me to a Broadway play. We used to talk about it all the time. I wonder if Mom remembers. After the dinner plates are cleared away,
Bitsy turns off the lights and comes out of the kitchen carrying a 7-layer cake. It is decorated with 16 pink roses. She and Jason must have been working on it all week. Everyone sings happy birthday. I make a wish and blow out the candles. The next afternoon, a windstorm kicks up, turning the sky brown and stinging my eyes with dust. I ride to the canyon anyway, hoping that Wolf will be there, waiting for me. But there is no sign of him, and I can't find a lizard anywhere. Chapter 34. I hope my mother doesn't bring the nerd to the opening night of Oklahoma. I don't want to hurt her feelings, but I can't stand the idea of him in the audience, sitting next to my family. Twice I come close to asking her not to bring him, but at the last minute, I don't. I decide it's best not to make a big thing of it, and by opening night, I'm glad I let it go, because I'm so full of excitement about the play that I don't care if he comes with her or not. The play begins well, and by the time I do my big number, the audience is warmed up and there is so much applause that I do an encore. At the end of the play, we all get a standing ovation. Reuben is the first person backstage to congratulate me. "You were great," he says. "I always thought you were shy, but I guess I was wrong." I don't tell him that a person can be shy and still do well on the stage. "You were really great," he says again, pumping my hand. "I mean it." I smile and thank him, and he gives me a quick kiss near my ear. As he does, I see Mom over his shoulder. She is holding a yellow rose and looking around for me. "Mom," I call, "over here." She hands the rose to me. "You were just wonderful, Davy." She kisses my cheek and hugs me hard. "I'm so proud of you." She is close to tears. "Come on, Mom," I say. "Everyone's looking." "Oh." She laughs, then pulls out a tissue and blows her nose. We perform again on Friday and Saturday night, and the boy who plays Curly, the male lead, develops laryngitis. Still, we are a great success, and my picture appears in the Monitor, the weekly newspaper. We have a cold snap the last week in April, and a spring snowstorm dumps 13 inches of snow on us the first week in May. But it melts in a day, and then the weather turns balmy. Everyone in school is hit with spring fever, and we all cut classes and go for a hike in the Hamas Mountains. There are wildflowers everywhere, and the sky is a deep shade of blue. Jane hasn't mentioned the pamphlets from Miriam. Of course, I didn't tell her they were from Miriam. I just said I'd seen them around the house, that one of Bitsy's clubs was discussing the problems of teenagers. When I gave them to Jane, she didn't say anything. She just put them into her notebook. Now as we walk through the woods, I say, "Did you have a chance to look over that stuff I gave you?" "What stuff?" "Those pamphlets on drinking." "Why should I waste my time reading them?" "Because you have a drinking problem." "I told you before, I can stop anytime I want to. I don't have to drink. I do it because I like it." "Why don't you stop lying?" I ask. "Isn't it about time you faced the facts? Isn't it about time you were honest with yourself?" "You're a good one to talk about being honest," Jane says. "What do you mean?" "You told me your father died of a heart attack. You call that honest?" She walks away in a huff. "Jane, wait," I call, hurrying to catch up with her. When I do, we walk together for a while, not speaking. Finally, I say, "How did you find out?" "Your aunt told my mother. I've known for months." "Why didn't you say something?" "I figured you had your reasons." "I couldn't deal with the truth," I tell her. She stops walking, faces me and says, "There are things I can't deal with either. Did you ever think of that?" "No," I tell her. "Your life seems so easy." "Well, it's not," she says. Chapter 35. When I get home, I phone Miriam's office, and set up an appointment for the next day. Miriam greets me warmly, as if I am a long-lost friend. I sit in the same chair as last time, although there is a sofa and another chair in her office.
I read about you in the monitor, she says. I wanted to see the play, but I was out of town that weekend.
It went well, I say.
I'm glad, she smiles at me.
Last time we were talking about your family, she begins. But I don't wait for her to finish.
I lied about my father, I say. I told Jane he died of a heart attack.
Miriam arches her back and leans forward.
Why do you suppose you did that?
I know why. Because it was easier to make up a story than to tell the truth.
Yes.
But since then, I wrote to a friend and told him that my father was shot and killed.
Did you feel better after you told him?
A little. But I didn't tell him all of it.
Do you want to tell me?
Sometimes I think I do. That if only I could tell someone, it would help. But other times I'm afraid. I'm afraid to bring it all back.
Maybe you have to bring it all back in order to be done with it.
I feel myself tensing, and I shift in my chair, unable to find a comfortable position.
Your mother was out with Jason on the night that your father was killed, Miriam says, prompting me.
Yes. Where were you?
I was in the backyard with my boyfriend, Hugh.
We were making out when we heard the gunshots. I thought they were firecrackers.
And then? Miriam says.
We ran to the store. I remember the sound of my screams when I saw my father on the floor. He was still alive. He said, "Help me. Help me, Davy." And I said, "I will. I will, Daddy." I held him in my arms while Hugh phoned for help. My voice is growing smaller and smaller. Maybe I shouldn't have come back here.
Can you go on, Davy? Miriam asks gently.
We'll stop if it becomes too difficult. I feel as if the real me is very far away. Not in this room at all. When I speak, my voice is barely a whisper. I don't know how long it took before the police and the ambulance got there. I heard the sirens from a long way off. And then the flashing lights made a pattern on the walls and ceiling of the store. By then, my father was unconscious. I didn't want to let go of him. The police had to pry me loose. They let me ride to the hospital in the ambulance with him. But when we got there, Daddy was already dead. The room is very quiet. The only sound is of an occasional car passing outside. Finally, Miriam says, "So that's how it was." And I say, "Yes." Then she looks away for a long time, and I'm glad. When she faces me again, she says, "It must have been terribly hard to hear your father asking for help, Davy. But there was nothing you could do. It was out of your control. I wanted to help him. I wanted to help him more than anything." I cover my face with my hands and begin to cry.
"Of course you did," Miriam says.
She hands me a box of Kleenex.
"I know how it hurts."
When our session is over, Miriam walks to the door with me. She puts her hand on my shoulder and squeezes it lightly.
"You're beginning to deal with it, Davy. And that's important."
I step outside. My head is pounding. Just as Miriam is about to close the door, I say, "I still didn't tell you all of it. I didn't tell you anything about the blood." And I turn and run. I run all the way home and go straight upstairs to my room. I open the door to my closet, look up to the corner of the top shelf, then quickly close the door again. I can't do it. I sit down on the edge of my bed. My heart is beating faster and faster, and I am sweating. "I have to," I tell myself. "I have to do it." I stand up and go back to the closet, flinging the door open, and this time, before I have a chance to think about it, I reach up and take the brown paper bag off the shelf. I grab the bread knife from the trunk,
shove it into the bag, and run downstairs. I ride Bitsy's bicycle as fast as I can to the canyon. I have trouble climbing down. I trip and slide several times. When I finally reach the bottom, I walk directly to the cave. The cave that Wolf showed to me. I open the brown paper bag and pull out the clothes that are inside. My jeans and my halter. The clothes I was wearing that night. They're covered with dried blood, and they smell terrible. But I don't care. It is my father's blood, I think. My father's blood. I hold them close for a moment, remembering. There was blood everywhere that night. Everywhere. It was splattered on the loaves of bread that were stacked under the cash register. It was dripping down the charcoal portrait on my father's easel. It was forming a puddle on the floor next to my father's body. It had soaked through his clothes. And when I held him in my arms, it soaked mine too. I fold the jeans and the halter and place them inside the cave, tucking the bread knife between them. I build a pyramid of rocks over them until there is nothing left to see. Nothing but rocks. Goodbye, Daddy. I love you. I'll always love you. This doesn't mean that I'm not going to think about you anymore. This doesn't mean that I'm never going to think about that night either. Because that night happened, and there's nothing I can do to change the facts. But from now on, I'm going to remember the good times. From now on, I'm going to remember you, full of life and full of love. I sit outside the cave for a while, letting the sun warm me. Then I get up and walk away. As I do, I see a lizard racing behind a rock. Chapter 36. 2 days later, a small package arrives for me. There is no return address. I try to make out the postmark. I think it says Big Sur, California. I open the package quickly. Inside, there's a white box, and inside that, a flat polished stone, as big as a quarter. Its colors change from brown to golden, depending on the light. It is beautiful. When I lift the stone out of the box, I find a note under it. A tiger's eye for my tiger eyes. Wolf. Where are you? I say to myself.
Los lagartillos corren.
When will you be back? But even as I wonder, I know that what matters most is that he is thinking of me. And he must know that I am thinking of him too. I hold the tiger's eye stone to my lips. When Mom gets home from work, she says, I've made a dinner reservation at Filomena's. For all of us? I ask. No, just the two of us. You and me? I say. Yes. Without Ned? Yes. Should I change? Should I wear a skirt? If you feel like it, Mom says. I think I will, I tell her. I take a shower, wash my hair, and put on a gauzy blouse with my tiered skirt. I carry the stone in my pocket. We borrow Bitsy's Volvo and drive down to Filomena's, which is the only decent restaurant in town. It is near the Los Alamos airport. We park in the lot, and as we walk across it, I look up at the spring sky and see Leo. The restaurant has a glass roof, and all of the tables are shaded by yellow umbrellas. I suppose that during the day, with the sun pouring in, it makes sense. But at night, it feels funny to sit at an umbrella table. We order green chili enchiladas and a pitcher of sangria, which is wine that tastes like fruit punch. I like the slices of oranges and apples floating on top. This is nice, I say. What I mean is that it is nice to be alone with my mother. This is the first time since we came to Los Alamos that it is just the two of us. Yes, Mom says. It's very nice. It's been a long time. Yes, Mom says. And I've wanted to explain that to you, Davy. She is arranging and rearranging her silverware, moving the spoon into the fork's place, then the fork into the spoon's. Up until now, I've been afraid to be alone with you.
Afraid?
Yes. But why? I was afraid you'd ask me questions, and I wouldn't have any answers. I've been afraid you'd want to talk about Daddy, and the night he was killed, and the pain would be too much for me. I did want to talk about it, I tell her, for a long time, and it hurt me that you wouldn't. I know, she says, reaching across the table and touching my hand. But I had to come to terms with it myself first. Now, I think I'm ready. Now I can talk about it with you. But now I don't need to, I say. The waitress brings her enchiladas. I take a bite and the green chili burns my mouth. I had to deal with it too, I tell Mom. In my own way. Mom nods. I guess we all did, in our own ways. My mouth is on fire, and I pour myself another glass of sangria. I think about Jane, and wonder how she's doing. She would probably guzzle down the whole pitcher in 5 minutes. I hope she's reading the pamphlets that Miriam gave me for her. Ned has asked me to marry him, Mom says quietly, not looking up from her food. I feel as if a bomb has been dropped in my lap. I can't swallow. But I've said no. I am so relieved, I pour honey all over my plate instead of into the sopa pia I'm holding. It's much too soon, Mom says. I like him, but I don't love him.
He can't compare to Daddy, I tell her.
No one is going to compare to Daddy. But Daddy is dead, and he's not coming back. I know that. Yes, Mom says. I guess you do. The waitress clears away our plates and asks if we'd like dessert. Want to share a bread pudding? Mom asks. Okay. I can't help thinking about the way we are talking about my father in one breath, and in the next, we are ordering a bread pudding to share. When are we going home, Mom? I hold my breath, afraid that she will say, "We're never going home, Davy." Instead, she says, "I've been thinking about it. I've been thinking we should leave as soon as school is over. What do you think?" What do I think? I am overjoyed.
I can't wait, I say. I can't wait to go home.
We'll have to sell the house and store. There's no way I could go back there, and besides, we'll need whatever money we can get for it.
That's okay. Maybe we can get an apartment near the beach.
Yes, that's what I've been thinking. And I'll have to find a job. I've written to Audrey and she thinks she might be able to help me land something in one of the hotels. I've got some credentials now. Maybe I can get into office management.
What about Jason? Have you told him yet?
No, I wanted to talk to you first. And Walter and Bitsy? Not yet.
What do you think they'll say?
I think Bitsy will be terribly disappointed. She's always wanted a family, and now that she's got one, it's going to be hard for her to give us up. I nod. But Walter will be glad. I doubt that. He's become attached to us, too. Not to me.
Even to you, Davy. It's just that he's a very rigid person. He only sees things his way.
I'm glad you're not afraid anymore, Mom.
Who says I'm not afraid?
You don't seem afraid tonight.
Let me tell you something, honey. I used you as an excuse to come out here. And then, as an excuse to stay. I kept telling myself it was better for you and Jason. But it was really better for me. Because I was so afraid. I was running away. Running away from the truth. Running away from responsibilities.
Did Miriam tell you that?
No. But it's what I learned through my sessions with her.
She's nice. I like her.
I thought you would.
Daddy was never afraid of anything, was he?
Not true, Davy.
He was afraid to take a chance on his talent. Afraid to give up the store and open a gallery. Afraid of not being a good enough husband and father. He was human. And you've got to remember that.
I miss him a lot.
I know. So do I.
But I think I'm ready to get on with my life. I think that's what he'd want me to do.
Mom smiles. It is a sad smile, and there are tears in her eyes. I reach into my pocket and touch the stone.
Hey, you're eating up all the bread pudding, I say.
Mom looks down at the empty dish, and we both laugh. Chapter 37. On Sunday afternoon, Mom and I go for a walk with Jason, and Mom tells him that we are going home. He is full of questions. Will Walter and Bitsy come with us? What about Minka? What about Ned? What about school? What if somebody tries to kill us?
Nobody is going to kill us, Mom tells him.
But what if they do?
They won't.
Atlantic City isn't safe. This is the only safe place, Jason says.
That's not true. Mom is firm.
Well, what about my cookies?
You can bake cookies in Atlantic City, Mom says.
But who will help me?
I will, I tell him.
You? He says, as if that is the dumbest thing he has ever heard. You don't know how to bake anything.
I can learn, I tell him.
Really?
He asks.
Yes, really.
For the rest of the day, I get the feeling that now that Jason knows we're going home, he is preparing himself. He seems to be drawing closer to Mom and to me, and pulling back from Walter and Bitsy. Little kids are amazing. They seem able to adjust to anything. I can tell that Mom is dreading telling Bitsy and Walter. She has decided to do it right after supper. Bitsy has a new pasta maker, and she is cranking out whole wheat spaghetti. The sauce has been simmering all day, filling the house with a wonderful aroma, making me feel hungry long before supper time. While we are waiting to be called to the table, Jason asks me to read him a chapter from Charlotte's Web. At the dinner table, he asks to sit between Mom and me. Walter looks as though he knows something is up. After dinner, while Bitsy is sipping her second cup of coffee, Mom tells Jason he can go outside to play. As soon as he is gone, she says, I have something important to tell you. Walter and Bitsy exchange knowing looks. Then Walter says,
I want you to know that we think Ned Grodzinski is one of the finest men we've ever met.
Bitsy smiles.
No, Mom says, realizing that they have it all wrong. This has nothing to do with Ned. This is about us, Davy and Jason and me.
Now Walter and Bitsy look at each other, as if to say,
Do you know what this is all about?
No, do you?
I'll never be able to thank you enough for all you've done,
Mom begins. I really feel for her. I'd hate to be the one to have to break the news to Bitsy. I wish she'd just say it quickly and get it over with.
What are you talking about, Gwen?
Bitsy asks.
It's time for us to leave, Mom says. It's time for us to start making a life on our own. We're going home. We're going home to Atlantic City.
No,
Bitsy says.
When?
Walter asks.
As soon as school is over.
But that's just a few weeks away,
Bitsy says.
Yes, Mom says.
I know. There is an uncomfortable silence at the table. I can't look directly at either Walter or Bitsy. I fool around with the crumbs that are on my plate.
What about the children? Bitsy says. They're secure here. You can't keep moving them around.
I'm not going to, Mom says. I'm taking them home.
But Atlantic City, it's not safe. You, of all people, should realize that, Gwen.
I can't let safety and security become the focus of my life, Mom says. I can't believe how sure of herself my mother sounds. I want to stand up and cheer for her. I thought we'd done everything to make you want to stay, Bitsy says.
You did, Mom tells her. You've been wonderful, both of you.
I doubt that I could have managed without you. But now, if you want to be on your own, we could help you find a place here, in Los Alamos. And you could get a permanent job at the lab. And the children wouldn't have to change schools again. We have the best schools. Everyone says so.
Bitsy chokes up. And I realize this is going to be harder than I'd imagined.
I can't stay, Mom says. Please, understand. I have to go home.
She is on the verge of tears, too. The calm, sure voice is gone. Bitsy stands up.
I think you're being selfish and unfair, she says, raising her voice.
Then she turns and runs out of the room. No one speaks for a long time. Finally, Walter says, she doesn't want to lose you.
Yes, I know, Mom answers. Chapter 38. I ride Bitsy's bicycle to the canyon for the last time. In the bike bag is the stack of letters I have written to Wolf. I climb down slowly, taking in the beauty of the canyon, knowing that I won't be back for a long time, that I may never come back. I want to remember the canyon exactly as it looks today. It is the place where I have felt closest to my father. At the bottom, there are lizards scurrying around. I sit on a rock and watch, turning the tiger's eye over in my hand. After a while, I put the stone back into my pocket, get up, and walk to the cave. I place the letters inside, next to the pile of rocks that are covering my clothes. I have written, "For Wolf only," across the top envelope. I want him to open that one first, because inside is my note thanking him for the tiger's eye. I'm sure he will come back one day and find my letters, and when he does, he will understand. I feel certain that we will see each other again. It just won't be today. Chapter 39.
This looks like a goodbye, Walter says to Mom, examining a car on Lemon Lot. Anyone who wants to sell a car in Los Alamos parks it here and potential buyers come to see what's available. The engine's clean, the tires are in good shape, and it will be good on gas, Walter says.
I like the color, Mom says. And the inside is attractive too. What do you think, Davy?
I like it, I say. It is a blue Subaru, and I wonder if it is the car that Jane threw up on the night we went out with Reuben and Ted.
What do you think, Jace?
Is it 4 or 5 speed?
Jason asks, as if he knows everything there is to know about cars.
5, Walter tells him.
That'll be better for highway driving. Right, Uncle Walter?
Right,
Walter says, tousling Jason's hair.
Should I make them an offer? Mom asks.
Let's go home, call them, and set up an appointment to take it for a drive, Walter says.
Okay. Fine, Mom says. And Walter, I really appreciate your help.
Walter nods and begins to walk toward the Blazer with Mom. Jason runs in front of them and I hang behind.
It's not us, is it, Gwen?
Walter asks. He doesn't know I am listening.
No,
Mom says,
because I've been thinking about it, and maybe I came on too strong.
You were strong when I needed you to be strong, Mom says. When I couldn't be strong myself.
We're going to miss you and the kids, he says.
Maybe you'll come to Atlantic City for a visit, Mom says.
Walter doesn't answer.
Jane comes over on the morning we are leaving and watches as I pack.
I don't know what I'm going to do without you, Davy, she says.
She is crying. She's been crying ever since she got to our house.
You'll be okay,
I try to reassure her. But I don't really believe it. She has admitted that she has a drinking problem. She took a test in one of those pamphlets I gave her, and the results prove that she has alcoholic tendencies and might actually be an alcoholic.
Now it is up to her to go to the alcohol abuse clinic and get help. I set up 2 appointments for her last week, but she freaked out and didn't keep either of them.
You're getting too dependent on me, I tell her. It's good that I'm leaving. It's really unhealthy when you get too dependent on someone else. Believe me, I know.
But you're my only friend, she cries, and I'm never going to see you again.
Sure you will, I say. You'll come to Atlantic City for a visit?
It's about time you saw the ocean. I laugh, trying to cheer her up, but it's no use.
I'm never going to see anything, she says. I'm going to spend the rest of my life here, in Los Alamos, just like my sister. I know it.
You don't have to if you don't want to.
I don't want to, but I'm scared not to.
You've got to stop being scared.
That's easy for you to say.
No, it's not.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean.
It's okay. Forget it.
Davy, Bitsy calls. Are you almost ready?
In a minute, I call back. Jane and I hug each other.
I'm glad we got to be friends, I tell her.
Will you always be my friend?
She asks. Yes, I say. Always. I'm throwing some last-minute things into my knapsack when Bitsy comes to my room. Your mother's waiting for you, Davy.
I'm ready, I say.
Minka is sitting on my bed wondering what's going on. I pick her up and look around my room. It looks the way it did on the day I came here.
I don't know what Gwen's trying to prove, Bitsy says.
I don't know why she thinks she has to do this.
La vida es una buena aventura, I say, pleased with myself.
I have picked up several Spanish phrases, and this is one of them.
What does that mean? Bitsy asks.
It means that life is a good adventure. Bitsy hugs me.
Sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't, she says. I'm going to miss you, Davy. I'm going to miss all of you.
I pat Bitsy on the back.
And I'll be so worried about you.
You don't have to worry, Aunt Bitsy. We're going to be all right.
Chapter 40. Jason races down the beach, his Dracula cape flying behind him. Mom and I are quiet, listening to the sound of the surf crashing against the jetty.
There are so many memories here in Atlantic City. But you can't go back. Not ever. You have to pick up the pieces and keep moving ahead.
I think about Linnea and Hugh.
Will they know how much I've changed this year?
Will they have changed too?
I'll wait until tomorrow to find out.
And then it's possible I won't find out after all. Because some changes happen deep down inside of you.
And the truth is, only you know about them.
Maybe that's the way it's supposed to be.
This is Emma Galvin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tiger Eyes by Judy Blum. This production was produced by Orly Moskowitz and directed by Taro Meyer. Text copyright 1981 by Judy Blum. Production copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.